Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, you're looking well today. I'm always pleased to see you.
Wine, books, exercise, nature, family, grandchildren.
These are the pleasures of life, of course, but I wonder if I might divert us from those pleasures of life and talk about a subject that I know was controversial for you, politics, and specifically the presidential campaign of 1800. I know this was a difficult time for you, was it not?
Mr. Madison is the founder of the old Republican Party, not the one that you all are aware of in the 21st century, but a Republican Party that was formed between 1794 and 1800. It was the opposition party to the Federalist Party that was the party of Hamilton and George Washington and John Adams. And Mr. Madison, believing as I did that the Federalists were taking the country in a disastrously wrong-headed direction, organized this group of friends who weren't a party in your sense of the term, but were like a party, and they began to find ways to oppose what we regarded as the aristocratic and monarchical leanings of the Federalists. And I had been a kind of a candidate for the presidency in 1796, although never in American history was there a more reluctant candidate for anything than I was for the presidency in that year, and I lost. I became the vice president because I received the second largest number of electoral votes in that campaign. John Adams became a one-term president. His presidency was destroyed by the alien and sedition laws and his ruinously warlike speech he gave about the conflict we were engaged in with France at the time. So his presidency was a one-term presidency. And in 1799, Mr. Madison said to me, "You must stand for the presidency and do more on your own behalf this time for the good of the Commonwealth. If you don't, history will regard you as having been unnecessarily selfish about your happiness and your retirement. The country needs to go in a new direction. You are the only person who can win an election against the Federalists. You must be willing to sacrifice your private happiness for the public good." And convinced that he was correct in his reading of the political situation, with enormous hesitation and reluctance, I agreed to be a candidate for the presidency in 1800. And as you know, after one of the most disputatious and vituperative campaigns in American history, I narrowly defeated my friend John Adams to become the third president.
You say your friend John Adams, but in fact, you were rivals of a sort, even at that time, were you not?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I was tall and thin, and he was short and fat, and I was a kind of serene, stoic figure, and he was a vain and earthy narcissist, and I was a person who controlled his utterances almost to the point of paranoia, and Adams never had a thought that he didn't express either in person or on paper. And I was a Virginia Cavalier, and John Adams was a hardscrabble Yankee farmer. And I was somebody who was more likely to restrain his public activities than to engage in them. And John Adams was a person who always wanted to be on the front lines of any political struggle. So we were quite different people. And in constitutional theory, we had separated pretty dramatically after the success of the Revolution. We both wanted a republic. That's what differentiated us, say, from Alexander Hamilton. But Adams was a pessimist who believed that humans are creatures of sin and lust and self-regard and aggressiveness and rapaciousness and a rage for distinction. He believed that humans are always about to spin out of control and become antisocial, and that the social order, the the government and our churches and our educational institutions and our voluntary organizations and marriage and every other public institution needs to work day and night to try to restrain this erratic, anarchic quality in the human soul, and that humans left to themselves will always make a mess of their world and their lives. I have a very, very different view of human nature. I believe that humans are by nature serene, rational, cooperative, gregarious, sympathetic, just, tolerant, and generous. And I don't believe in original sin. And I don't believe that a world without restraining institutions would be pandemonium and madness. I believe that it would be a little disorderly from time to time, but that it would get along quite well. Thank you very much. So our constitutional theories were quite different. Adams, I think, was a monarchist. He would deny that, but I think that he was. He was certainly a believer in aristocracy. I'm not. I believe that we should work towards an equalitarian system, and I am 100% antagonistic to the idea of an American monarchy, no matter whether we call it a presidency or a kingship. So there are all these differences, but we still were dear friends. We read the same kinds of books. We had been together in Europe during a very important time in his life and in my life. We had been two of the five members of the committee which produced the Declaration of Independence, and we were the two most active members of that committee. In a sense, we were the two pole stars of the revolution. I in the South as the philosopher of the revolution or its penman, and Adams in the North as its floor captain at the Second Continental Congress, as the orator, the man of legislative activity and resolve. And so between the two of us, we probably did more to bring the revolution about when it finally came than anybody except George Washington. So we were extraordinarily close in many important respects. I admired his wife. He and his wife had befriended my daughters, Martha and Maria. We exchanged little services for each other, I in Paris and Mrs. Adams in London. We got together with great frequency. And so we were, John Adams and I, two members of that little band of brothers who lit the fire of the future of the world on July 4th, 1776. And for all of the trouble that followed, and there was a great deal of tension and trouble between us, for all of that, I tried constantly to keep my focus on my respect for John Adams, the man, and I hope that through all of that, he was able to keep his love and respect for me, the Virginian.
Could you talk about the different feelings the two of you had regarding England and France?
I do very much admire France. I said that every man's first country must be his own, but every rational man's second country is France. You know, I loved my time in France. I love the French people. I love their elegance and their rationality and the way that they have taken music and painting and sculpture and dance and conversation and salon hospitality to its very highest pitch of excellence. I said that you could spend your entire life in France and never hear a single rude remark. It's a marvelously civilized and cultured country. And when you compare that to England with its beef-eating people and their common sense and their deliberate anti-intellectualism and their disdain for the fine arts and their bloody-minded and bold conversation, I can't compare the two cultures without greatly appreciating France and, in a sense, despising England. And I'm so glad that we Americans, although we're of English stock, are a little different from those repressed and dour Englishmen, those beef eaters of London and Birmingham. And if I had the choice between spending the rest of my life in Bordeaux or in Manchester or the rest of my life in Paris or London, it wouldn't cost me one second of deliberation. But John Adams, quite the opposite. He was, of all the Americans of this period, he was the closest to John Bull. You know, John Bull was kind of a caricature of an Englishman, just as Yankee is a caricature of an American. He was John Bull. He was English in his physique, in his habits, in his speech, in his aesthetics. He was as English as any person who is an American could ever be, and he loved England. He loved what England was. I couldn't love England. I loved the Magna Carta. I loved the British Civil War and the British Bill of Rights. I loved John Locke and Newton and Bacon, but I didn't love England. My love went to France. And so these were obviously just personal interests and affiliations, but I was deeply grateful to the French for the treaty that came in 1778, thanks to Benjamin Franklin, the Treaty of Perpetual Amity and Mutual Aid. That treaty helped us to win the Revolution. The Revolution would have been won no matter what, but the French alliance is what enabled us to win it as we did and when we did and as completely as we did. And we had formed this alliance with France in 1778. They were the first country in the world to recognize us. And we owed them something. We owed them a great deal. And when the politics of the 1790s began to be volatile, weak Americans began to detach themselves from France because it was undergoing a revolution and to realign themselves with Britain. I regarded that as outrageous. The British had never done us any good. The British were trying to re-enslave us economically, even though they had lost us politically. And just across the English Channel were these elegant, generous, liberty-loving Frenchmen who admired us and wanted to, in some regards, incorporate into their own society the great gains in human rights and rationality and good government that we represented. It wasn't a contest to me, but John Adams, when the crisis moment came, aligned himself with England, and when that moment came, I hesitatingly, but nevertheless clearly, aligned myself with France.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. We need to take a short pause now, if we might, and I'd like to continue this conversation after the break.
Indeed, we shall.
You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and joining me again is President Thomas Jefferson. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Jefferson, we were talking specifically about the campaign of 1800, and I'm very interested to hear more about it, probably because we get so many questions from our listeners about the current campaign, and I look at that campaign as the beginning or almost the defining moment of the two-party system in America.
Unfortunately, that's probably true. If I can just back up and provide a little bit of historical perspective, it might be useful to your listeners. The country was formed as a nonpartisan entity in 1787. So much so that the Constitution is silent about the possibility of parties. And the Constitution has some structural weaknesses in it once parties are admitted as part of the equation. So the Constitution makers were as idealistic as I was in hoping that this would be a nonpartisan culture. For the first 12 years of the Constitution of the United States. The government was controlled by George Washington for two terms and by John Adams for one term. So I regard those as 12 years of Federalist government. The Federalists are called so because they wanted a federated system with a strong national government, and they were opposed by the Anti-Federalists, led by people like Patrick Henry, who wanted states to be the center of our national enterprise and the national government to be tiny and almost non-existent. So the first fissure, which occurred during the ratification process of the Constitution, was between the Federalists, who were pro-Constitution and pro-strong national government, and the Anti-Federalists, led by people like Patrick Henry, who wanted extremely limited national government. Well, then these Federalists, who had set up the government, and very ably, may I add, they governed the country between 1787 and 1800. In 1800, I believe that the Federalists had so badly managed government, particularly in John Adams' 4 years, that they had lost their capacity to be respected by the great majority of the American people. In other words, that there was a genuine loss of confidence in the Federalist capacity to lead us into the 19th century. The Federalists were great men, but they, in a sense, were backward-looking. They looked across the waters towards Europe. They wanted European-style. They were squinting at monarchy and aristocracy and class systems and, you know, levies for the president and a court like the monarchical court in England or France, and a very strong economic engine at the center of the national enterprise, and war as an instrument of policy, and war as an instrument of glory seeking by men like Colonel Hamilton. So the Federalists were, I believe, beginning to show their true colors, and those true colors put them at odds with the great majority of the American people, who were mild-mannered farmers going about their lives. And if once a government becomes detached from the great majority of the people, that government needs to fall. And nobody wanted to do this because these were my friends, John Adams, George Washington. These were great men. These were the men who built the Revolution. These weren't just political opponents. These were men who will be remembered historically with the deepest respect as long as humans love liberty. And so to oppose them not only seemed personally disloyal, but it also shattered the image of the founding fathers in the American Revolution. I didn't want this role, but if the Federalists stayed in power, I believe they were taking us towards monarchy and aristocracy and a nation controlled by its richest and most privileged beings. I couldn't allow that. And so even though I didn't want to be this person, I decidedly did not want to be this person. And even though my own philosophy of life means that my personal relationships are more important to me than my political affiliations, and even though I just wanted to finish Monticello and repair my fields and turn a profit and pay off my debts and do something to liberate my slaves, I agreed reluctantly in 1800 to be pushed forward by James Madison and others to stand against my old friend Adams and against the legacy of my old friend George Washington. It was painful in the extreme, but I did it. And in the end, I defeated Adams. I tried to make sure that this was not going to cloud our personal friendship, but in fact it did.
It would seem to me, Mr. President, that you and your contemporaries recognize that for the Republic's sake, civil discourse, dialogue between all of you was necessary. At the same time, anyone involved in politics has to exhibit a certain level of passion. There's a contemporary phrase, dirty politics, and there are those who say that that type of politicking began in this campaign. There were some things that I would suspect you are not proud of.
It didn't begin in the campaign of 1800, but it certainly became a significant factor for the first time in 1800. And it worked both ways, of course. I was accused of being a French radical, and was often compared to Robespierre. Just think of the absurdity of that.
Well, people were afraid you were going to import the French Revolution to America. Is
indeed,
that right?
They were afraid that I had been sufficiently intoxicated by the Enlightenment and by the French Revolution that I would, in some sense, touch one off here. And one Federalist newspaper said that if Mr. Jefferson is elected, we could expect dwellings in flames, female chastity violated, hoary heads bathed in blood, and children writhing on the pike. You know, a French reign of terror.
Goodness.
In America. Well, it didn't work out quite that way. That was one charge. Another charge was that I was a philosophical dreamer who would make a great college president or should write newspaper columns, but I was unfit for the real practical business of running a country. And Hamilton, in a famous letter in 1800, called me, quote, an intellectual voluptuary. And he did not mean that as praise. He meant this is a man who is lost in an ivory tower of his own utopian readings and is not grounded sufficiently in the actual world in which actual human beings live and work, that he cannot be trusted with the reins of power because he's an intellectual voluptuary. That was the second charge. The third charge against me was that I was an atheist. That I had suspiciously rational views of Christianity, that I was not a believer in the basic tenets of Christianity, by which I mean Christ crucified and risen on the third day, and that an atheist, in their view, could not be trusted with the presidency of the United States, that whatever else was true, the president of the United States had to be somebody who believed in the central doctrines and the basic facts of Christianity as it was delivered to us by St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. So that was the third charge. And then there was one further charge that was leveled against me, and that this was done rather more subtly, but it was certainly there, and that I had been a coward and a failed governor during the darkest period of the Revolutionary War back in Virginia, that I had, in the face of Bannister Tarleton's foray up the mountain to Monticello, that I had fled away to seek my personal safety, and that a person who was cowardly in the face of the British invasion of Virginia and wholly inept as governor of Virginia during that terrible crisis was somebody that you don't want controlling a great nation, which is still in crisis in 1800 with respect, say, to France and England. And so those four charges were leveled against me all of my life, but with virulent energy during the election of 1800.
In your time, how were these charges put forth?
Newspapers, sermons. People attended church sometimes for 3 hours on a Sunday. Several times a week people would go to church, sermons, pamphlets.
There would be a great outcry in America today if churches were used as a political tool. They were in your time,
they were
one
saying? Of the chief tools. And a correspondence, people would write circular letters that would be read not by the one recipient but by many. I suppose this is a little similar to your listservs or your internet activities in your time. And people would post a broadside up on a post, on a tree, on a fence, on the side of a building. So all of these methods were used, and there was a fairly good
network. There was organization behind all of this. Excuse me.
Yes, there was organization, and there were anonymous newspaper columns. You know, people wouldn't sign their name, Rufus King or Alexander Hamilton or John Adams or John Quincy Adams. They would sign their name Publius or Camillus or Catullus or the names from classical history of the Greeks and the Romans, and these would be anonymous. We would normally know who was behind these things. I never wrote for the press. I never wrote anonymously for the press, but others certainly did, both for me and against me, to be candid. And these assaults were very widespread. And I should say just one more thing about this. Underneath it all, sort of as a deep background rumor in 1800, were questions of my own propriety as a man at Monticello with respect to a slave woman. People weren't overt about it yet. It hadn't broken into the national media, if you want to call it that. But but there were circulating rumors that Mr. Jefferson's sexual character and character as a planter and a man were suspicious.
But they did break into the media via
18-2.
The hand of James Callender, did they not?
In 18-2, a drunken journalist by the name of James Callender published in a Richmond newspaper the allegations that Mr. Jefferson kept a Congo harem and that there was a woman in particular by the name of Dusky Sally.
I'm curious to know, you just said you never wrote for the press, but others did. What involvement did you have against your opponents?
Personally, none. I tried to keep myself above the fray. I never wrote anything, never uttered anything that could be construed as personally negative. I didn't write ad hominem, and I didn't speak ad hominem.
Does that mean that you avoided being identified, or does that mean that you had no involvement, sir?
I had no involvement. That's the first level. Personally, no involvement. Secondarily, James Madison and others on my behalf wrote articles for the press and circulated pamphlets defending me against the charges that I have already outlined, and also arguing for my capacities as a leader and as a bona fide figure from the Revolution. And they also, in a principled and rational way, disagreed with the policies of the Adams administration. And so this was politics at its very best. You defend your own political candidate, you put forward the best argument you can on his behalf, and you make a principled argument against the policies and the behavior of the opponents. That was the second level. The third level is the one that you're pointing to. I didn't do this overtly, but indirectly, I loosed a number of attack dog journalists. I didn't tell them what to say. I didn't put ideas in their mouths, but I encouraged them to do what they could to question the Adams administration. And in the course of their doing so, they often descended to a level of vulgarity, character assassination, scurrilousness, and irresponsibility that frankly embarrassed me and still embarrasses me. But they were working indirectly for me and on my behalf. In other words, I didn't say, attack John Adams as a fool. I didn't say John Adams is wholly unfit for the presidency. Say that John Adams is a hermaphrodite. I didn't ever say any of those things, and I couldn't and wouldn't, and it's not my style. But I did give some indirect encouragement to people of that third tier who turned out to be character assassins and unscrupulous men. I would never have sanctioned what they said. If they had come to me with their copy and shown me, I would have tried to edit out anything that was that personal and ugly. But I didn't put a stop to what they did either. And so I'm in some sense responsible, and I should add one more element in the name of candor. I did provide some cash payments to one James Callender, who was one of the principal character assassinations of John Adams. Now, I didn't do it in order for him to try to assassinate the character of John Adams. I did it in order for him to be able to pay his bills and continue doing his work as a journalist. But there is a linkage between the cash that I gave him and the mean-spirited assaults that he made on John Adams' character. I could have put a stop to it. I didn't know about all of it. I certainly didn't approve it, but I also didn't stop it.
It sounds a bit complex, not the nice, neat world that I would have expected. If Mr. Madison was writing on your behalf, I find it difficult to believe that you weren't aware of that.
I knew that. We didn't talk about it. We had a tacit agreement between us that we wouldn't talk about it. So that it wasn't for deniability's sake. It was that people think that, you know, in your time, people think I'm some kind of a Machiavellian figure who is working behind the scenes, but it's not true. I didn't want to know about it because my personal style is to believe that we live in the best of all possible worlds and we can all get along and these things can be worked out rationally and there's no room for ad hominem or unscrupulous behavior. And I love to live in that world. And so in some ways, the less I know about the grubby parts of the world, the better off I'm going to be.
Well, let's leave that part of the world, if we might, and move into a better time after the election, what people refer to as the Revolution of 1800. You had a vision for America, and you had a chance to put it into place. Could you speak about that a bit, sir?
I will, but I must close the previous discussion by saying this wasn't all on one side. If you had read the newspaper attacks on me by men who were encouraged by John Adams, you might be quite surprised. I wrote a letter to Elbridge Gerry in 1799. He was a good friend of mine, and I outlined my platform, if you want to call it that, leaning over on behalf of peace. Not peace at all costs, but peace if anything can rationally be done to secure it. A rather smaller army and a rather smaller navy than the Federalists wanted. Much more frugality with respect to people's tax monies. In fact, an elimination of all internal taxes. A belief that there should be separation of church and state and unlimited freedom of religion. Some restoration of states' rights so that the states would no longer feel that they were being swallowed up by the national government. An encouragement of science in all of its branches, because a well-educated, scientifically curious nation, a nation that seeks knowledge, is going to be a much greater nation, and a belief in a mixed economy, but a preference for the agrarian sectors of it. Those are the fundamentals of my policies as a president of the United States.
So did you accomplish all that, Mr. Jefferson?
Not all of it, but I did reduce the national debt by 37%. I reduced the size of the army and the navy. I restored peace with France, and that enabled us to secure the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. I restored a good deal of sovereignty to the states and lowered the tone and the energy of the national government. On the whole, I think that my presidency was consistent with my philosophy and successful as a Republican presidency.
Thank you very much, President Jefferson. I have truly enjoyed our discussion today. It's always a pleasure to have a conversation with you, sir.
You are most welcome.
We need to take a short pause, but when we return, we'll be speaking with the man who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. You are listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson, who is seated across from me now. Good to see you, Mr. Jenkinson.
David Swenson, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. It's great to see you here on the second floor of the somewhat chilly New Enlightenment Radio Network barn here in Bismarck, North Dakota. Merry Christmas to you.
Same to you, sir. And you know, this marks my the beginning of my third year as semi-permanent temporary
guest host.
Yes, it does.
Amazing. Well, I won't change the title because I have a fondness for it.
And it rolls off your tongue. But to the subject at hand, dirty politics.
Well, we got right into it.
Yeah, we did.
Today, I don't know what to make of this as a historian. Jefferson believed what he said today, that he was a reluctant politician, that he wanted a nonpartisan country, that he was above the fray, that he tried to take the high road, that all things considered, he preferred friendship and the band of brothers to the hard work of politics.
And France.
and France. So that's what Jefferson says. Increasingly in the last decade or so, led by my former student Joanne Freeman of Yale, there has been this really wild attack on Jefferson, suggesting that he's really just not only a garden variety politician like everybody else, but that he was the master politician of his age, and behind that serene Enlightenment facade is just a vicious little political infighter who destroyed his enemies and always wound up on top and was somewhere willing to do whatever it took.
Somewhere between those two opposite poles is probably the truth, don't you think?
Well, here's how I see it. I'm not sure that I'm right, because we don't know. You know, Jefferson is famously elusive. The greatest of all of Jefferson's biographers, Merrill Peterson, said at the end of working for 20 years on Jefferson, he said, "I find him impenetrable." Mm-hmm. And Henry Adams, the great-great-grandson of John Adams, wrote a two-volume, gigantic history of the Jefferson and Madison administrations, and he said, you know, all the other founding fathers could be painted with a few brushstrokes, but Jefferson takes a very fine pencil, and you never quite get the shadings of his character right. And John Adams said of Jefferson that he's like our great rivers. You know there's a bottom to them, but you can't see the bottom. There's so much of it is subterranean, and it escapes the rational eye. I think all that is true of Jefferson. Joseph Ellis, a great Jefferson biographer and a great student of American history, one of my favorite American historians, has called Jefferson the American Sphinx. So Jefferson is not like Hamilton. Hamilton is what he seems to be. Hamilton is an arrogant, brilliant policy wonk with a taste for beautiful women and a prickly sense of his own honor, but a brilliant contributor to the American fiscal machinery and a much better prophet about the future of America than Thomas Jefferson. And John Adams is more or less what he seems, a kind of irascible but cuddly founding father who was so full of himself that he could barely see, but when he saw beautifully. You know, these people, you can understand them, but Jefferson is feline and he's elusive and he... There's a
feline. Now, that's feline. A good one.
He is feline. There's something, I don't know what it is about Jefferson, but you can never pin him down. When you think you've got him, there's another Jefferson standing over in the corner smirking at you. I don't quite understand him, but here's what I think.
Feline.
Feline.
You know, if I might interject.
Beautiful adjective.
Recently, I heard a quote attributed to Churchill, paraphrasing. It was, "Cats will always look down on you. Dogs look up to you, but give me a pig. They'll look you in the eye every time."
Well, that's
so
Churchill.
So if it's feline, we're looking down, are we not?
There's a certain porcinity to Churchill's character, although he's one of my favorite historical beings, and his wit is extraordinary.
I apologize for the diversion there.
Well, Jefferson is not fond of dogs. Shakespeare was not fond of dogs, interestingly enough. Shakespeare's references to dogs are all negative. Jefferson was not fond of dogs. Jefferson never mentions cats, so I don't know. There obviously were cats at Monticello. Cats are the greatest mousers that exist, but I don't know much about that.
But you're talking about Jefferson's character, elusive and feline and politics and dirty politics.
So when you're with Jefferson, so let's say you're Jefferson's, let's say you're Aaron Burr. Jefferson doesn't like Aaron Burr. Jefferson doesn't trust Aaron Burr. Jefferson believes that Aaron Burr is... a ruffian and a man of loose morals and a man who would sell his grandmother for political advantage. Jefferson needs Aaron Burr, but Jefferson doesn't trust Aaron Burr. So Aaron Burr comes to Monticello to see the great Jefferson. And while he's there, Jefferson is friendly, philosophical. He serves great wines. They go out on horses and tour the estate. Jefferson gives Burr access to his books. They have splendid, remarkable, probing conversations about history and philosophy and mathematics and Newton and Locke and Bacon and art and agriculture and the future of human liberty. And Jefferson bends over backwards to get Burr the best tea and the best ale, and he serves him beautiful food, and they have an incredible time. And Burr likes Jefferson because you can't not like Jefferson. This man has more in his brain than any other 100 Americans, and he's interested in everything and curious and graceful and polite and always civil. And Burr is with him, and he thinks, I like this guy. B, he likes me. And C, we get along splendidly. And so he leaves. And then a month later, he finds out from somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who talked to Madison that Jefferson called Burr the American Catiline and a man wholly unfit for public responsibility and a person who, if he had never lived, the Republic would be better off. And then Burr thinks, wait a minute, I was just there and he treated me as well as a human being could possibly be treated, and we bonded and it was harmony and we saw the world eye to eye, and he led me to believe that he really liked and admired me. How can this be true? And people then would say, well, one of two things is true. Either Jefferson is a contemptible hypocrite, or these rumors are not true. When George Washington heard the same thing, that behind the scenes and to his friend of his friend of his friend, Jefferson was saying awful things about George Washington, Washington wouldn't believe it, and he wouldn't believe it, and he was doubtful and skeptical. And then finally something tipped him, and he thought, I'll never trust this guy again. This is a very common experience. And Adams was even more interesting in this regard, David, because Adams knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jefferson had tried to destroy him.
So wait a minute. You're saying—
But he loved him. He couldn't not love Jefferson.
You're saying all these contemporaries of Jefferson's wanted to believe that he was a good guy.
But did for a long, long time.
But eventually they all figured out that he wasn't. Is that what you're saying?
No, they didn't all figure out that he wasn't, but most of them figured out that he wasn't the civil, generous guy that he seemed to be. And then they shook their heads and they tried to figure it out, and but they could never come to Jefferson and say, hey, look, you said this and we were like that, and now explain yourself. They couldn't do it because Jefferson was so serene and so stoical and so civil and so detached that you could never confront him. Only two people, or really three people, ever confronted Jefferson. Abigail Adams.
Right.
John Adams.
Right.
And James Madison. Abigail Adams finally said, you know what? You are disgusting. I don't trust you, and I'm right and you're wrong. Only person who ever said that to Jefferson got away with it. This is 1804 when his daughter died. She wrote him a letter of condolence. Jefferson replied. He said a lot of stuff that wasn't strictly speaking true. And then she just let go and really just told him off as nobody ever.
This is a letter.
Yeah. And her letter is breathtaking in its aggression towards Jefferson. And then she says, and furthermore, I don't ever want to talk to you again, and just breaks off the communication, which is the worst thing that can happen to Jefferson because, of course, he wants to keep the dialogue going. John Adams, in the late correspondence, which I highly recommend between 1812 and 1826, says again and again, you did this. Explain yourself. I perceive that. You must come clean. I demand you to tell me why you said such and such. And each time Jefferson, he's like a wrestler who slips out of the corner, or a boxer like Muhammad Ali. He takes a bunch of rabbit punches and then he dances around. But you can never, John Adams wanted to say, stand in front of me so I can punch you out. And Jefferson wouldn't. He would dance around him and give him a compliment. And he seduced John Adams all over again until in the end, John Adams said, oh, the hell with it. I just love you. I know you've done rotten stuff, but I just love you. Can't we just love each other? So Jefferson won that one. But Madison is the great one because Madison's Jefferson's closest friend. And Madison loves Jefferson and admires Jefferson and is Jefferson's lieutenant and Jefferson's collaborator. He's in some ways Jefferson's politician. But Madison, many times in the course of their 50-year relationship, must have thought, this is a real pain in the ass, this Jefferson. Because he says one thing and he does another, and he's always has this Teflon quality to him and makes me do all the dirty work for him, and then he detaches himself from me when I get caught and blah, blah, blah. But Madison would never confront Jefferson. He would say something like this. The idea which you have suggested to me in your most recent brilliant letter undoubtedly would be the perfect idea in a utopian world. But because we happen to live in this sublunary world where things are much less than great philosophers like yourself will see, I suggest the following 28 corrections on your letter. And then he goes and he just completely destroys Jefferson's concept, but in a polite, flattering, respectful, generous, best friend kind of way. And then Jefferson will say, well, I believe we could live in the utopian world, but in the meantime, let's just go with your 28-point plan. And so Madison's able to do it. But he never says, no, sir, you are wrong. Madison's the only one who knows how to talk Jefferson down into a better Jefferson.
Huh.
It's a great, great achievement. But think of how hard that must have been for Madison. You get the letter, and the letter says, you know, we should cancel the debt every 19 years. And then Madison thinks, okay, how am I going to talk him down into a more pragmatic approach to the world without upsetting the great philosopher at the mountain? And he does it. It's exquisite, but it's the deepest act of love that Jefferson ever got in his life. But those are the only three people of any historical significance who ever turned their criticism directly at the great one.
I was hoping today that we would have a conversation about the campaign of 1800, in part because of all of the letters that we've been getting from our listeners about the presidential campaign that we're going through now, and also because of a book called A Magnificent Catastrophe by Edward J. Larson, which
I— Good book. I've been reading.
Larson writes in the book that these men, they could write like angels and scheme like demons. And it really does. I mean, it was nasty, dirty politics during that period, wasn't it?
It was. It's been dirty ever since. But that was a particularly violent election. This was a polarizing period in American life. And the country was coming to terms with the same thing Jefferson was coming to terms with. Oh, there's no unanimity amongst the founders. It's actually going to be an ongoing debate about what the revolution means. There's going to be an ongoing dialogue about who we are and how we operate in the world. This was not a finished settlement. This was a preliminary settlement. And people that we regard as the sort of the Rushmore of American heroes are actually at odds with each other in some fundamental ways. And what does that mean? And how do you broker difference in a free society, in a society with utopian underpinnings? These are hard, hard questions. Today we don't feel that, David. Today we think all's fair. You know, that we don't, there's no unanimity in the country. We don't owe anything to the myth of America. It's have at it and score for your side whatever you can. But let me ask you a series of kind of yes or no Socratic questions to compare. You keep talking about the campaign of 1800. So let's just assume that we're in the campaign of 2007. What do you think someone like John Edwards is doing today in Iowa?
I'm not sure if I understand.
What's his day look like? What does his day look like?
Oh, I would bet at this point they are at a fever pitch.
Doing what?
I would bet that his handlers are—
Of which Jefferson had none.
Right. I would bet that his handlers are monitoring the news by the minute and adjusting his schedule by the hour.
What does the schedule look like?
To maximize his contact with people and his opportunities for more press.
What kind of events might he go to today?
I wouldn't.
A breakfast.
I would. You know, a breakfast, certainly.
Jefferson never. A news conference.
Oh, I see what you, yeah.
Jefferson never.
Right.
A meeting with funders.
Okay.
Jefferson never.
You're destroying my comparison between
the two. No, I'm not. I'm just saying, okay, it was a campaign.
I see your point, yes.
It was a campaign, but Jefferson stayed at Monticello and never left. He never gave a speech. He never asked for a campaign contribution. He never asked for a vote. He never had a news conference. He never called a rich industrialist to say he would quite like to have $100,000. He never did anything. So it was a campaign, but the principle, this Machiavel we're talking about, was growing turnips and writing polite letters about cloud formations and taking down weather data twice a day and supervising the winter activities of his crops. It's a very different picture.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson campaigned in the sense that he did absolutely nothing.
But it began the process of destroying your opponent as well.
Well, in the course of the day, he might say to Madison, I understand that James Callender has been doing some good work on his analysis of the weaknesses of the Adams foreign policy. And then Madison would say, yes, that's certainly true. But, you know, he has been writing some pretty violent and icky stuff about Adams. Jefferson would say, well, if you have any way of dealing with him, try to tell him to back away from the personal a little bit and keep it on a more policy plane. And then Jefferson would say to Madison, but is it working? Is that kind of dirt that he's dishing on Adams working at all? And Madison would say, well, it does seem to be having an effect. And Jefferson would say, well, make sure he knows we're not in favor of this, but don't come down too hard on him.
Well, this is a conversation that I always enjoy having, Jefferson and politics. I always learn from both you and Mr. Jefferson, and so it's been a spirited discussion this week, but, sir, we are out of time.
Sorry to hear that, but I do want to say that Thomas Jefferson is endlessly interesting, and anybody who thinks they know who Jefferson was is almost certainly oversimplifying, because he is the most complex of all the founding fathers, and he's one of the most complex figures in American history. And the more you know about Jefferson, the less you can conclude. That's what's so extraordinary about this man who was the third president of the United States.
Always good to talk to you, Clay.
We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Broadcasting and brought to you by the New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. President Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. If you would like to obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 1-888-828-2853. Again, that number, 1-888-828-2853. The program is also available online at www.jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you would like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the show, visit the website. Again, that's www.jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas.